bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Brian Brushwood.
Is it happening yet? Have I reached Sawyer levels of long hairness? I just need the
You're
dimples, I think.
There.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Well, Mr. Bryce Castillo, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's getting longer, but I don't know. You still look like Shaggy to me.
Yeah. At least I've learned not to wear green shirts.
Very, very interesting to see where the comparisons of Brian's haircut are from Bryce and from Brian. like Brian's like, so what? Yeah, do you think I have the hair of the Studley heartthrob? Like, do I have Studley heartthrob hair? It's like, oh no, you look like Shaggy. You know, the cartoon stoner.
He solved mysteries.
Yeah.
He did.
He ate a lot of sandwiches, though.
I feel like I look like meth buyer number four from Breaking Bad right now.
Hey, yeah. Man, you're talking to meth buyer number one and number two from...
Parolee number one and parolee number two from the upcoming film released this Friday, Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison. We're in the credits. It is officially there. People have seen the movie, I guess, in different regions. It's been released already. Very, very excited to support our buddy Romney.
The trailer looked great. I didn't know. I knew you guys did a while ago, and I saw this trailer on Apple Movie Trailers, whatever. I'm like, wait. And I click and I watch it. I'm like, I know what this is. And I'm going back to a couple scenes. Like, are they? No. Okay. But still, but it looked really good. I'm excited to see this.
Yeah. We are definitely in a blink and you'll miss it moment in the movie, but, according
which is probably for the best.
To Romney, it's definitely a scene that's stuck in there. And, man, that Red Band's, trailer really sings. Like it looks really funny.
Yeah. That one's really good.
Yeah.
So
that's
yeah,
off to him.
I'm sure we'll plug it with things, but yeah, Parolee number one and Parolee number two at your service.
Which one got top billing? Which one got number one?
Oh no. Justin was the star of that. My job was to be just tweaking the entire time.
Gentlemen, I want to talk about something completely different now. There's been a big hot startup space has been getting more into neuroscience. We've talked before about Neuralink, which is one of the companies that Elon Musk started, which was designed to sort of build brain interfaces, sort of the neural lace from the Peter F. Hamilton books and the idea of this interface between your brain and computers. He recently talked about the idea that you'd be able to use it to play music directly into your head. There's another, which we could talk about that, but there's another company, Kernel, which is, I think they had a new round of financing, but they're another one of these stealthy startups. And their goal is to develop another kind of, they're working on some non-invasive ways to sort of monitor brain activity. And they're kind of a little bit evasive about what they're working on, but very interesting. They've got some funding from some pretty big funders, Coastal Ventures, General Catalyst, et cetera, and on-demand access to our world-leading brain technology. So they're looking...
What would this mean? You put on a hat and you set the dial to productive for the day, and then you get out and in a million vague little ways you feel nudged to get more done, or?
Well, that's not what they're putting right now. Most everybody's just talking about right now either monitoring, seeing what goes inside of the brain to try to get that more closely. Neuralink has talked a bit about people with like severe like motor disorders and other conditions and stuff to try to use it as a treatment for that. This is sort of more like basically just their Kernel's talking about research, and basically talk about like, monitoring stuff. They mentioned like brain health, drug discovery, the idea of knowing what's going on inside our head when we take stuff. Like you take a thing like aspirin, we have theories about why aspirin works and what aspirin does, but it's been something used for 100 years. And there's a lot of other things that, well, it works, and you didn't get an extra arm, so we guess it's good, but to be able to know what's really going on inside the head, probably a good idea.
We're talking about breaking down the black box, because like we don't even know why anesthesiology works. It's just magic to us, but we know that it works, and that it allows us to take out, you know, appendices and so on.
Yeah, and there's like things like, you know, there's research right now using, like, let's say, microdosing, like LSD, or there's some using other hallucinogens for helping people deal with trauma and stuff. And it's very controversial, but it might, you know, and that was in an area of research years ago looking at the potential for that. But the problem is we just don't know enough about what's going on, and the fear of like, well, this is really strange. Technology like this, like I said, it can help us understand what's going on inside of there. And there might be things that we said, no, this is crazy. We might go, oh, no, there's value here, and let's monitor this very closely. For instance, let's say drug use, you know, how do you cure addiction and stuff?
Well, and that's fascinating, because I mean, obviously in addiction specifically, there's a lot of conversation about exactly how much it should be treated as a like disease versus a like mental impediment or something like that. And I think this would really be the like, a step toward bridging that gap. Because anybody who's been through addiction or had addiction in your family, you know very well that it's very much both of them. Like there is definitely dopamine reaction that changes behavior. And also it's something that you can get over through therapy and stuff like that. So I would be fascinated to see studies where we could actually see like where these dopamine hits are coming from and how fast they're doing it, and just really understand so much of these things that affect our culture.
How far off does that put us from something where and now this is me totally making something up, but let's say there's a baseball cap that you can set a bar on and just say, I want to get more in the habit of, we were talking just before we went live about, you know, making the bed every morning. Like, imagine we start very small. It's a hat that you wear, that you set a dial, and you start with just one simple task. You get an extra dopamine hit when you make your bed every morning. And at some point you don't even need the hat. It just trains your mind to be the kind of person that makes your bed in the morning. Are we cool with that level of behavior modification?
I think that going into the chat, Tally Zarell, who pointed out, who knows way more about this stuff than you know we do, is that you get into, she brought up plasticity of the brain. And anytime you try to modify or do something and change a behavior within the brain, there could be repercussions. And the first step is really, I think with the first step, Brian, would be like a Fitbit for the brain. It's just a Fitbit to sort of know like, hey, Brian, remember that really productive day you had the other day? This is what was going on before. What did you do? And you're like, I played Hearthstone. What? Like, 18 minutes of Hearthstone, 22, you go into a lull state, you know? So I think that'd be the first one, is just that data. But yeah, I mean, now, you know, we can put probes in the brain and like, I taste like chocolate.
And even without probes in the brain, at the very least, we now have the data, with the wearables that we have on there. We could track and just at the end of every day, your watch can ask you, scale 1 to 10, how productive were you? How happy were you? How whatever, blah, blah, blah. And after a year's worth of data, it's going to be able to say, hey, man, not for nothing, but 70% of the best days that you've had have begun with you going for a walk. Feel like going for a walk? All you got to do is 20 minutes, check yes, no. And then after that, it's like, great. Just saying, bro to bro, your other best days follow about 15 minutes playing Hearthstone at this point, and then so on. And like, I that feels so much less intrusive, but no less effective.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it'll obviously, we'll figure out more what we think is good or not. But again, you have, you know, Tally in here to talk about this. But, you know, when they look at like the Radix can pull the lever and get the most sugar and things like this, they've done other stuff like just straight electrodes in there, press a button, pleasure with monkeys and stuff. You just keep pressing it, you know, you just keep pressing it over and over again. So the idea is, if we're thinking machines, give ourselves information to allow us to sort of change the way we function or the way we work, rather than just straight on, like, let's just hit this. But But there might be cases of people with like severe drug dependencies, things like that, where it might be, no, we're better off bypassing this electrically and then eventually weaning you off of that, because otherwise you're going to be 3 months.
Yeah, that's one of the parts that blew my mind when I was reading about like a brain monkey cocaine studies where they had a button to just, mm-hmm. you know, jack cocaine right into their brain. Is that...
Where do you sign up for these studies, by the way? Do you have to be a monkey?
But
who books that?
There were two types of monkeys that were studied, and the alpha monkeys, the ones who are in charge of the entire tribe, apparently just very rarely would be like, yeah, I don't know, and I'll hit this one. Yeah, that's kind of fine. Whereas the monkeys that felt powerless, that were at the bottom parts of the social structure, just could not get enough of hitting the button that made things feel a little bit more okay.
Either way, I mean, I think in terms of this conversation, the biggest thing that we've is the beginning of the idea of like our quantifiable self. And that's like Fitbits and wrist trackers and like all this stuff. You know, Brian, I know you use your Pebble a lot for sleep, like to say like, okay, peace of mind on how much you got sleep. And presumably what you do with that is try to figure out, okay, well, what's the optimal time that I should go to sleep? Like, how do I, you know, like, do I feel better if I, you know, have more or less, blah, blah, blah. But where I think we are still trying to figure out is that we are harvesting a lot of data, but we really have not found great concrete ways to kind of understand it. Everything is its own piecemeal solution, where I think if we have now this kind of granular level, all right, here's how your brain is processing all this kind of stuff, I feel maybe like even just having that other piece of data now can quantify a lot of this stuff that we're already tracking in terms of fitness and sleep.
Yeah, and I suppose what we definitely lack is some kind of self-reporting, moment-to-moment quality of life action. And maybe that's something that could eventually come to an Apple Watch or something like that, where it's just like, if there's something that can measure those either automatically the indicators of joy or manually, you know, by triple tapping on your watch, like this was a good moment. That felt really good.
When they have like emotional journaling apps where you say like, how was your day today? And you like look at trends that way.
Is it easy to do or because it sounds like homework when. Well, I hear it.
it's a thing that I know that it's a thing that is kind of already used in some form of therapy. So I don't know how you automate it. I don't know how you pull data out of it. But
I mean,
but
I think
there's
part of this also
doing that
though,
already. Yeah.
Like Brian, you do like it is work if you want to get something out of it, right?
Sure.
Where I think like ultimately. Yeah, if you wanted to be like, all right, I have a commitment to track my happiness. I want to like mark out where I feel the most productive, where I feel the happiest, and the best way to do that is by just recording my thoughts and emotions. You know, that will. It is going to be work. It is going to be sacrifice, but hopefully the juice is worth the squeeze.
Right. Right. I'm just saying I would love for all that to happen and require less effort on yours truly. Stop me if you've heard this one before.
Well, I think it's exciting for the ability to collect data. And like, yeah, before we start, you know, and here's the pleasure app button. Is scary, but we're going to get that. You know, I think that the exciting thing about this is that there is an entire area of getting that data and doing that. One of our friends, you know, Dr. Paul Zak, you know, he's got a whole company that's using the stuff like, how do you monitor brain performance, whatever, to help improve, you know, outcomes for different situations, both for companies and things like this. It's a growing area, but it's also going to be, my fear is that, you know, we're going to get, you know, the company's like, we figured out how to respond. We figured out a way to the pleasure sensor. And now we have the button to press to make you feel good. And it's like, well, maybe that's where you want to go, but let's get some more data first. And that's what's exciting about Kernel's idea of the potential, the promise of let's get a lot of really good data. Know what the hell's going on in there before we start, you know, wiring us up, you know, to machines. Anyhow, I think it's an exciting area. If I was somebody who had studied in this area and was knowledgeable about this and listened to the show, I would be reaching out to some of these companies that are doing this, because I think it's a very hot field. Very, very, very hot field.
Not talking to anyone in particular who might be in the chat right now.
No.
Not talking to a very smart person who we rely on for correcting us and giving us really good factual information.
Just speaking in general. That's what we're doing.
General terms.
And now is a great time because telecommuting, you know, working with other organizations.
It can erase borders and commutes, you know, just there's a lot.
Telemedicine is huge.
Hypothetically, one person here may be working with another company that was, you know, high tech we've talked about before, entirely by a video conference call. And so you never know what's possible. So
you never know. You never know. Here's what we do know, friends, and that's your support makes this show go at patreon.com/weirdthings. We'd like to thank everybody that has become a member on patreon.com/weirdthings. You guys are making the world go round for us, and we could not be happier about it. Head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings. Get your custom RSS feed so you can have the episodes out even faster than they come out on Apple and Spotify and everywhere else that people listen to it. Thank you so much, everybody that has done it. And thank you to anybody who will do it in the future. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
You know what? Just thank you to everybody who's doing it. Everybody doing it. We're so glad you did it.
Thinking of a Mel Brooks movie when you said that.
Oh, you do it. We all do it. I just did it, and I'm ready to do it again.
One of my favorite sort of pet theories, it was a fringe theory a while ago, and now it's actually gaining more credibility. We've talked about this before, and there's actually some more evidence about this, is the idea that Neanderthals may have made it to America. And the reason that that's always been sort of hesitant is, one is, like, it's not, you know, you base your sort of archaeological theory on things you find, and absence of what we thought were Neanderthal artifacts and stuff would be kind of a good reason to think, like, you know, they never made it here. There was this one incident where somebody found like a Neanderthal hand axe somewhere in, like, you know, like Mississippi or North Carolina or somewhere in a riverbed. And they're like, wow, a Neanderthal hand axe. And it turned out that there had been like a boat that's boiler had exploded, and a lot of the times the ballast they would pick up in Europe would be a bunch of European rocks, and they think it was just ballast from there that got there.
Which, oh my gosh, so it's the equivalent of like a Martian space rock that like a meteor hits Mars hard enough that Martian rocks just kind of fly and then land at the South Pole on Earth. So similarly, it's like, well, we just need some rocks. Let's grab some rocks. And then through man-made movement, suddenly it shows up over there. That's crazy.
Yeah, but there's been some other evidence of, like, really, they used to talk about what was like Clovis, which was like what we thought was like, you know, there was the oldest sort of proven sort of area which had human habitation in Americas, you know, the Clovis settlement. And then they talk about pre-Clovis. And we keep moving
Clovis,
that date.
New Mexico, or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow, that's really inland. I would have expected more like Alaska.
Well, again, that's not saying the first spot. That's like where we found the best evidence.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of places, like the further north you get, the further subject they were to glaciation and stuff too. But there are other older stuff we've been finding. So we've been finding, it used to be, we don't know, pre-Clovis, not so sure now. Like, yes, we know they were there before because they didn't just teleport to there. But there is some, actually, there was a couple articles that came out about, you know, finding some other sites of like 100,000-year-old, 130,000-year-old, the California Struti mastodon site, where this is 130,000 years ago, where scientists have said, hey, we found some bones that look like they have the same sort of fracture marks that Neanderthals used when they were cracking open bones. Highly subjective, but interesting, because just as a backup, 130,000 years ago, we had another interglacial. You know, we had another up and down period, so you could have had a spread of Neanderthals and maybe even Homo sapiens, and then we had the Ice Age picked up again.
I mean, I guess that makes inherent sense to me, just in that what our monkey brains want is a simple narrative, but the way almost everything happens is noisy. So if I picture a noisy progression from one area to another, then it seems like part of that noise would certainly involve both Homo sapiens and Neanderthals at the same time, right?
Yeah, or Neanderthals way before. But yeah, I think that's I think noise is sort of the best way to describe it, because like, you know, we wanted that old school, like, this is the human tree and it starts here and it's just this straight progression here, and it's like, that ain't what happened. It's a bush and dead ends and stuff, and co-minglings and dirty hominid sex, you know. And so
dirty interspecies. I mean, look, you know, liger didn't happen by accident. I mean,
no.
we're the ligers of, you know, hominids here. We're part Neanderthal, part Homo sapiens. Some of us are
also
part
magical. Yep.
Yeah, that too. So I like this because I think that part of it is that in some cases, like in archaeology, you would say, well, we're not going to go bother looking for human things here because why would there be? And there's a lot of amazing stuff that's still in museums and stuff. That was, you know, Jack Horner, who was a paleontologist, he was working with, was Mary Schweitzer, was the one that decided to crack open. They had a T-Rex bone, and they couldn't fit it onto this helicopter because they were in the middle of the Badlands, wherever they were getting this from. And Jack's like, well, we'll just cut it in half. And I'm like, well, yeah, you cut it in half, you glue it back together, it's still a T-Rex bone. And then Mary Schweitzer's like, hey, can I look to see what's inside of this bone? The evidence of those proteins, you know, this you cracked open and saw what looked like cells that looked like other material like that. There is a couple papers or stuff talking about the fact that they found these weird little balls of iron that when they tried to pull them apart, they looked like they may have been fragmentary DNA. And that came from, let's cut a bone
open
and see what's inside.
The pilot of that helicopter, Michael Crichton. Yeah. Just putting that out there.
It's like, hey, what's going on back there? But that goes to show you that, like, we don't know. There might be a lot of stuff just sitting in boxes, museums and stuff. They're like, well, now this is 60,000 years ago. It wouldn't be like, let's go back and take a look. We don't know. You know, there might be instances where there may be, once you sort of know that something's possible, you look at things differently. So,
yeah, I wonder how quickly we're going to get to a point where we can so perfectly scan things as they are that we feel entitled to break them apart and find out what's inside, because that's something that would be just totally anathema right now. But I mean, at some point we're going to know everything there is to know about the outside of the head of this, you know, Triceratops or whatever. And it's like, well, why are we keeping this thing around when we could find out what's inside and just start breaking it apart?
Well, yeah, that's Horner sort of talk about. There's a lot of, like, we have a lot of T-Rexes. It's like, we got a lot of T-Rex bones. You know, it's not a super, super rare specimen compared to other ones. And he's like, yeah, just crack them open. And part of it too, is it like, yeah, paleontologists who are used to studying, let's say, the morphological structure of something, and then you have a smaller subset of, like, the number of people doing paleo microbiology is much smaller. So for part of it comes down to, oh, my skill set's this. I'm not ready to crack this thing open because what am I going to do? And I've encountered this, like, I've dealt with scientists who are, like, doing, like, you know, have cameras counting, like, fish swimming by a camera and trying to count how many species there are, and their way to count the species of, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage is just to have a graduate student with a clicker. And you're like, well, you know, computer science, like, you could build a thing in 4 hours that would do image recognition, and they just look at you like, what is this magic called image recognition? Right. And you're like, this person's one of the smartest people I've ever met, but that's the domain issue. So I guess that's the thing here. It's sort of that domain issue.
Well, and exactly what, where it's like, in the world of media, I implore people to not make the mistake of people think, what do I have and what can I trade it for? What do I want? You know, what I have is a stage show. What I want is money. And that's the whole world they live in. And that, you know, we've talked about it on After Things or whatever, is why I implore people to remember there are multiple currencies and that you can trade. You know, by taking the long way around, you could get much more results in a more automated kind of way.
Uh-huh. And I think it's the advantage of, you know, we some things got brought up here about, you know, the problems of like funding, et cetera. And it's one of the things in working with people across disciplines, you know, going across, leaving your particular department and going across the campus to go talk to somebody in a different field, go talk to the electrical engineers about imaging, you know, go talk to them about this stuff and say, hey, what are you guys doing that might be cool here? And some of the best developments in science have happened that way.
You know, years ago, and this is like Matt Ridley's point of ideas having sex and coming up with new, you know, mutations as a result.
Yeah, I had a friend that was a member of the California Academy of Sciences, and one of the things he talked about was like they did a cool expedition where they brought like biologists and even like physicists and a bunch of cross-disciplinary people, and they did an expedition to like Borneo or something. And then what it was, instead of sending one person out from the field there, they brought a bunch of different people from disciplines. End of the day, they just talk about what they observed and what they saw. And it's just one of the most illuminating thing in the world, because all of a sudden, you know, the botanist is talking to, talking to somebody who's a specialist in, let's say, a certain kind of an ant, and they point out something about the tree structure, whatever, the leaves fall, and all like, oh yeah, oh wow, I didn't realize that. That might explain this. And you know, talking to people is a great idea.
it's a bit like, and I guess we should bother to tell it, even though it seems kind of cliche and trite to us because we've heard it so much. But you know, the parable of the five blind people who encounter an elephant, and because each of them is feeling a different part of the elephant, it's like, well, this is clearly a tree because you're grabbing a foot, or you know, this is very clearly a snake because it's grabbing a snout or whatever. Yeah, people should talk. That's our controversial take.
You know what people need to talk about, too? Have you guys received any mystery packages in the mail? Any mystery seeds?
No, I
have to ask whether or not you're a cop.
Am I a cop?
What's funny is I did receive a text message from our friend Michael Amar, who grows his own miracle berries, miracle fruit, and asked if I wanted some. So unless that's what we're talking about.
We'll add him to the FBI watch list, because people around the country reporting receiving packages of mystery seeds they did not order, and the origin apparently is China. And so there's some warnings have been sent to people like, hey, if you get these mystery seeds, don't plant them.
That's amazing. Okay, what are these mystery seeds?
We don't know. We just know that apparently people have been receiving mysterious packages postmarked from China containing seeds with no other instructions. And so now they're putting out warnings to people like, don't plant these seeds.
I mean, so you should at least eat them, right?
Yeah. So, like Justin keeps saying, what?
Yeah, well, no, because we just keep looking at it, and there it's postmarked from China. God knows how, like, this is a weird thing.
Well, have we studied them? What do we know? So here is another weird thing that we know is happening from China, is that people are getting random merchandise from China. And usually what it is it's part of somebody else's credit card scam or whatever. They have to make quote-unquote legitimate purchases using stolen credit cards, so they just pick an address at random, so all of a sudden you get like a knockoff Pikachu or what have you. So people are already getting weird stuff that they did not order from China. China also is a market rich in exotic herbs and spices. So it doesn't surprise me entirely if this is an extension of that story, where this is really part of just a stolen credit card testing front.
Well, maybe. The problem is that these things have been marked incorrectly, and with the other sort of some things they'll do, like they'll mail items and ask for reviews, and there's some other reasons. So that was a connection that was drawn. Like, is this related to this? But like, these have been mismarked as other stuff to sort of bypass the agricultural thing. And if you're going to send something for that, you don't want something that's going to normally would get stopped at the border for, you know, by the Department of Agriculture. And so multiple states, South Carolina, Minnesota, et cetera,
Oh, that's right. I see you as pointing out that another aspect of it was sometimes they were sending them to people to goose their online sales rankings or their star reviews or whatever. Their Alibaba legitimacy, you know, number of items.
So, Dr. Whiskey, apparently this is happening in Tennessee where he lives, and he says that the agriculture departments are afraid that these are invasive species, which if you're not familiar, you can look up, like, kudzu is one that has really just taken over and is like kind of a botanist nightmare in terms of it just never going away. And it's very, very hard to contain. But another one that I wound up covering way back in the day when I was writing for the Morning Call in Allentown is hogweed. Are you familiar with hogweed?
No.
So it is an invasive plant that is, it actually looks kind of pretty. Like it has like these like white little flowers that pop up from it. Unfortunately, its sap can produce third degree burns.
Whoa.
When applied to your skin can cause third degree burns. And I wound up becoming aware of this. The story that we were telling was a local council member was just obsessed with how hogsweed looked and was just very for it. And he's like, well, you know, number one, I think the scientists are lying about the sap burning you. And also it looks pretty. So I would rather have these all throughout this, you know, a very blue collar area of Pennsylvania. And he was throwing the seeds out there, and he was part of the reason why it was
he was
spreading.
Johnny Acid Seed.
Basically. Yeah, he was an awesome guy to cover, because he gave me my two best stories I think I ever reported on were that one, and then he also misgendered a prison guard on purpose, and it wound up getting probably the best story I ever wrote was a prison guard who was transitioning while you know, serving as a prison guard, which was awesome. Awesome story because of this one asshole.
Wow.
This, apparently the UK, they've been getting them too. It's one of these things where like, probably they're going to be a very stupid, innocent explanation here. But the other thing, like, as you said, the idea of like, you know, if you wanted to be a jerk and spread a lot of invasive species somewhere, just send them some seeds and stuff. And
well, that, you know, we don't, that would also be, man, not to get too tinfoil hat, that seems like a very, very cost-effective, easy Skunk Works Operation Mayhem thing to do. Like, if you've got a budget and you're part of a government and your directive is, you know, mess stuff up, that seems like a very cost-effective way to create just a little bit of chaos. You don't know. Yeah, like any seed, you don't know which of them will bloom into 1,000 problems.
Yeah, like maybe not reporting right away you had a leak from one of your labs of a coronavirus.
Yeah,
letting right? it become the world's problem before you went out and said, hey, listen, there's something going on here. Like, I don't know. It's one of those things like, I'm like, need more information. Need more information.
But
by the time we get more information, it will be science and no longer weird things. So yes. So we're reporting at exactly the right time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I agree. No, for us, yeah, we're exactly right there. But like, yeah, I don't find anything logically wrong with any of your theories, Brian.
Yeah. Makes them no less weird.
Yep. Gentlemen, you want to do picks?
Tijuana Jackson, Purpose Over Prison, available on Friday. Go. We had Romney on Night Attack, so if you want to hear him talk about it, then please do it. It's the story of a man who gets out of prison and wants to be a motivational speaker, and the relationship he has with his parole officer, who's played by the hilarious Regina Hall. Brian and I have Blink and You Miss It cameo in the movie, but please support this, because to me, nothing would be funnier if this is like one of the 20 movies that come out in 2020 that we can do a 4-year consideration campaign with Romney and Regina Hall. Like
we were joking.
If there's only 20 movies coming out, then Romney has his best shot ever at an Oscar, and we will indeed put some muscle into it if we can. So let's try to make this hit.
Keep in mind also, I mean, we've moved the needle on various projects. We are our crowd, our team, Diamond Club, Chat Realm, you know, all of the weirdos out there. We know the limits of what we can normally do. This is an unbelievable year in which all of the rules have changed, and it's possible that all of us buying this movie twice, once on iTunes, once on Google Play, will get it to the top of the charts. And then after that, we can make the right amount of noise in the right order that our friend with this independently financed outside of Hollywood regular system movie could win legitimate awards. Like, if you wanted to make a list of the things that it would take in order to have Brian and Justin appear in an award-winning movie, one of those things might involve a global pandemic that breaks the entire movie system for just 1 year. Guess what? Here we are.
Or murder, suicide. Don't rule that one out, guys. That's be a documentary. Yeah.
yes, no, definitely, definitely. Everybody buy this movie. My daughter, out of nowhere, I guess... one of the nice things about kids is that they don't tend to remember anything that they saw 4 years previous. And so Josie,
it's a weird thing to say, Brian.
Well, so Josie, you know, had recently watched Avatar: The Last Airbender. But then she was like, hey, was The Legend of Korra good? And it's like, I don't know. Let's take a look. And I'll say, I think this series gets a little bit distracted after the first season, but the first four episodes of The Legend of Korra is fantastic beyond words. It's got J.K. Simmons in it. It is a totally different take. If you've watched Avatar: The Last Airbender but have never seen Korra, do yourself a favor. Watch Korra. It's coming to, if you don't want to spend money, it's coming to Netflix, I believe, on August 14th. So sit back and wait for it. But The Legend of Korra is great.
Did I see you and Uncle Jason running around the backyard with your shirts off drinking moonshine?
Oh, go back to sleep, sweetheart.
Episode 22 of Modern Rogue. My pick is, I just went back to go reread the book, but thought I'd also watch the movie to 1984.
Oh, wow. And... both of which are really good.
Yeah, I picked before Mr. Jones, which was just a great account of, like, you know, a journalist, an idealistic journalist who was, you know, supported the kind of the communist ideals in 1933 going into Russia and discovering what was going on in the Ukraine. And it's a really good example of like what happens when well-intentioned people sort of come face to face with the reality. And part of that story too was about George Orwell. And they open up with sort of a bit about Animal Farm, et cetera. And this was a guy who was very much not initially a critic of these ideals, a guy very much supporter of those ideals. And then his analysis of it and, you know, Animal Farm talking about the Russian Revolution, 1984 talking about sort of what happens in, to some degree, what happened with, like, propaganda, et cetera, throughout World War II and sort of a larger scale. One of the things that struck me was very interesting was that you go back and you look at it kind of from looking at through the lens of his time and what he'd observed. We tend to think about 1984 and propaganda and stuff being the thing for the masses. But the primary target of propaganda in 1984 was the educated class. You know, Winston was a guy that worked in the Ministry of Truth, basically changing historical accounts in newspapers. The proletariat, the masses, didn't care about that stuff. That was the educated class gaslighting themselves, which I thought was sort of a very interesting sort of touch, because we tend to think about, like, all those dumb people being easily manipulated. And part of what Orwell is saying, like, well, actually, here's the quote, smart people being very easily manipulated because of their ideals. And so, again, I enjoy reading it again because you just pick up themes going, oh, ah, you know, like, it's there. It just wasn't obvious to me. And this is part of what he was addressing, you know, was that.
If you can find it, there is a version of it that's read by Frank Muller, who I've mentioned multiple times, is my favorite audiobook reader of all time. He gives a weight and a gravitas to it that is just delightful. I don't think it's currently in rotation in Audible, so you might have to get creative on finding it. But the Frank Muller version was fantastic.
Excellent. Look that up. Because, yeah, I think I want to do an audiobook version of it next. So that's my pick. Bryce?
Yeah, I got a pick. This is, you may know the work of Zach Gage. He is the designer behind Spell Tower.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
Cool.
He's got, I forget the name of the Apple Arcade game, but he's got a new game out with Jack Schlesinger called Good Sudoku, which is a evolution of the Sudoku format. If you don't, you've probably seen Sudoku. It's the 9x9 grid where you have to fill in all of the numbers so that each number only shows up in each column and each row and each square only one time. And what's really interesting about Good Sudoku is I guess they've written a bunch of algorithmic smart computer stuff to help teach you how to play and how to teach you techniques.
Oh my goodness, that looks astonishingly close to the markings that I make when I play regular Sudoku, because mm-hmm. Sudoku is not a game of guessing what goes in a square. It's a game of eliminating everything that can't be in a square,
right,
and then putting in, you know, the what remains. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so wild. That's exactly how I mark mine up.
And it's really one of the really nice things about it is, as a part of all the smart stuff that they put in there, if you ever get stuck, you know, you have a hint button and it'll say, hey, this is the next step that you need to make. Like, it can look at it on the fly and say, okay, this is the next step because these two cells have this condition, and you can hit a button and it'll show you the things that you need to.
So it doesn't give you an answer. Instead, it reminds you of the process that you haven't done yet.
Sure. I mean, you can use it to when you hit the hint. I mean, you get the hint.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really cool. Like and the other nice thing is it's free to play. Like, if you want it to be ad free or to have like colors and stuff, I think it's $4 or $5. My only criticism of it is a very ephemeral one that I believe will get worked out, but not all of the smart stuff in the game has been totally figured out. They have a mode, so there's play mode where you play puzzles, and an improve mode where they have all of the techniques and it will generate a puzzle and say, hey, you can use this technique in this situation. Go and find it, or hit the button and we'll show you and you'll learn how to do it. Some of those don't work yet. Some of them, it's this weird bug where it'll generate a puzzle and you'll spend 5 or 10 minutes looking for the right cells, and you'll hit the hint button and it'll say, this is not a solvable puzzle. It's like, what am I supposed to do with that? They know about it. They've got updates coming, but I think it's really cool, and you can start it for free. And they've got like a wide range of difficulties. So like, you can start with very easy stuff where there's always going to be a single cell available, up to stuff where, oh, there are techniques where you have to look inside of the 3x3 squares, and then techniques where you have to look outside of that. It's very cool, and it looks very sharp. The sound design is very cool. There's a really good like cha-ching sound when you get stuff right. So it's called Good Sudoku. It's on iOS. I don't know if it's on Android. Probably not. I don't think Zach Gage makes a lot of Android stuff.
Yeah, because it's called Good Sudoku, not Spyware Sudoku.
Okay.
Gentlemen, it's been good weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.